This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 35, for Monday, September 15th, 2008, Codapalooza Conversation. Today's interview is actually a roundtable discussion with some of the speakers and the attendees from the Codapalooza event that was held on September 6th, 2008. Let's listen in. Hi, this is Larry Clark, and I'm recording this podcast on location at Charlie's Ale House right after Codapalooza in Chicago.
Wow,
how
what
you
a
doing,
day.
Dave?
Hey, I'm doing good. How you doing, Larry?
Yeah. So, Dave, you called me out about a week ago.
Yes.
You said Thirsty Developer needs to get back to its roots. Our shows were becoming a little structured. You said we need to get back to our roots of drinking beer and just having conversations with cool tech people.
Yeah, conversations in a bar.
Yeah. So actually, we're at a table with seven or eight of our closest tech friends, and
for today at least.
Yeah, for today. Yeah. after this podcast is posted, they may no longer be our friends, but we're just going to kind of ask what people are up to and ask a couple questions about kind of trends in technology and stuff like that. Just conversations that you might have with somebody if you just were having a drink with them.
That's right.
So I want to throw out the first question, and that is, how was Codapalooza, everyone?
This is Chris Williams. It was awesome.
Jason?
You gonna put me on the spot? Okay, this is Jason Bach from Agenic. I thought it went really well for the first time I did it. Well, actually, I got a good night's sleep last night, which is surprising, and I haven't drank anything yet either, so that's even better.
Yeah, we're working on that.
But
so
you've done a bunch of data.net stuff down here, so you got how many people? Wait, 300?
Well, we have about 300. We think today showed up. So, I mean, we used to do data.nets here in Chicago. We did seven of them. So this is our first Codapalooza. And actually, I don't know if Jason remembers, Jason was in the first day of .NET.
Oh, yeah, I did the dynamic proxies talk. I still remember that, getting the looks of, huh?
Do you still have the deck?
Yeah, I did my reflection talk today, and I mentioned, because I've updated that, the dynamic proxy stuff, so I actually mentioned that. I just didn't do a whole talk on that, so then I'd really get glazed over looks. So, but I think the event went really well. I really enjoyed it. So.
Yeah, and this is the first to kind of mini community events, kind of the fall after everybody's back from the summer. Chris, you're actually planning an event up in Minneapolis. Why don't you tell us about that real quick?
Sure. This is Chris Williams. I'm working on the Charity Fragathon, which is a Halo 3 tournament and fundraiser for Children's Hospital. And it's being held at the local Microsoft office. And you can go to www.charityfragathon.com for more information.
And do people do you pledge money to play, or
Well, there's a $10 donation for admission, and that gets you into the tournament and gets you some pizza and just an opportunity to hang out with some cool folks, as well as play some Halo, play some Rock Band 2.
And because this is a charity thing, people ought to think of the $10 as the absolute minimum
Absolutely.
To donate, right?
You're certainly welcome to donate more.
Give till it hurts, and then make sure your employer matches, is what I always say.
Right.
So I want to move into it. So that's a great event, and we're looking forward to that. There's some other events coming up, in the area. Jason, you got a code camp coming up?
Yeah, we got this is Jason. We have a code camp in the Twin Cities, Twin Cities Code Camp 5, which is October 11th. It's going to be at the New Horizons Center. And last I heard, we had about 180 people signing up, so we're getting close to our cutoff. So it's a pretty good event, and we're actually looking forward to seeing where we're going to be going beyond this, because we're looking at moving on to a different location after this one, because we're running out of space. So it's a good event. If you're in the Twin Cities area, try to sign up soon.
And where do people go to sign up or find out for more information?
Go to TwinCitiesCodeCamp.com, just as it said. So,
excellent. So now I thought I'd just throw some questions out there about, kind of where we're going in technology, because I think we're in an exciting time right now. Most of the people here are Microsoft technologists, but you can talk about whatever technology you'd like. I guess I'll just throw it out there. It's like, what's the thing that people should pay attention to right now, if they're looking at, forward-thinking stuff? Jason, you have the mic, so you want to give us your thoughts?
This is Jason. Not really. I really need a beer. We're talking about having beers. We don't have beers at the table yet. That fosters creativity. What? Oh, Kirsten said something. Here, Kirsten.
I have no beer.
Kirsten, can you introduce yourself?
This is Kirsten Jewell. I'm from Minneapolis. I'm a developer. The question is, what should people pay attention to?
Yeah, what's the upcoming technology trends? And not necessarily upcoming, but kind of what's hot, what people should be paying attention to,
or what are you excited about? What's your passion today?
Oh, well, mine is kind of probably boring to a lot of people. I'm a former engineer, so I've been kind of looking at using some of the tools to make your code better, make your process better, to drive some quality into your development process.
So what was your session on today? You were one of the speakers today.
I spoke on TFS today.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is because TFS, the way that it...
Team Foundation Server?
Team Foundation Server and the Team Edition, Visual Studio, has a lot of developer tools, test tools. The testing tools are pretty neat with the variety of tests that you can do. And I'm just kind of looking at what can we do to improve our quality code and do it from the beginning. Because I've been on several projects where some of these things aren't looked at until the very, very end, and then it's very much too late.
Well, so I mean, it sounds like you're passionate about, you know, writing better code and being a part of a better software development process. So I remember in my career as a developer, there was certainly a time, I don't know if this is where I hit that sort of maturity level in my developer career, or just maturity level from a maturity standpoint, is that there was a point in time where it's just pound out code. There was a point in time in my career where I started getting more interested in the process of building good software. The process of doing good source code management, the process of doing good builds, and making sure your applications were, you know, not only functional, but they were against the right requirements, and you didn't break code when you made changes. So that's where these tools are kind of leading us, you know, with the advent of VSTS and some of the other application lifecycle management tools we have out there. So it seems to be your passion is around TFS.
Well, actually, I'm a developer, so I'm the happiest when I'm deep, deep, deep into code. But kind of where I started this is, in my engineering background, sorry, there's some a waiter talking about beer. My engineering background is, you know, you can take the girl out of the manufacturing plant, but you can't take the engineer out of the chick, I guess. No, I'm a chemical engineer, and I did a lot of product and process engineering, and that's how I got into software. Was I had to write a bunch of software to monitor my processes, and I was having more fun doing that. So then I completely switched over, and I've been totally software developer for almost 10 years now, I
guess. Okay, so one quick follow-up question. What's your language?
What am I doing now, or what have I done?
Either one. Both.
Well, I do mostly C# now, but, I mean, I've done Visual Basic. I had to do Fortran once.
Alongside with Kirsten, with why TFS is great is, you know, it's come a long way, but more and more people are realizing that the real cost of development is the long-term maintenance cost.
Yes.
And if you can make your stuff better, it will be cheaper.
Yes, and I was just saying, okay, going back to, no, I'm a developer, the process stuff, the reason I am interested in the process stuff is because I want to spend my time solving really cool problems and writing good code. And the way you can do that is, like Keith said, make sure that your process is good, that you're developing quality code so you can spend less time writing crap and less time fixing crap and more time writing cool stuff. And that's just kind of the result of being on a couple projects where you watch it and it's so frustrating, and it's like you're watching the ship sail off the cliff here or whatever, and you're powerless to stop it because you're just a code monkey and you don't get to make the decisions. And I said ship. With a P.
She held her tongue. You know, I am a pirate kid.
And for me, the developer, just the extreme frustration I felt at those times, where as an engineer, I said, well, I know the solution because we've done this on the manufacturing floor. There are ways to build the quality in so that it's not an effort, so that once you have your process and you understand and you kind of have your metrics going, and Jason's raising his hand. Sorry, I'll wrap this up. So basically, there's more time to focus on writing the code and solving the problems and not going back and redoing things and rewriting the code. Yeah, Jason?
Oh, this is Jason. I wasn't going to necessarily continue on with that because I think you did an eloquent job of summarizing what you wanted to say. I was getting back to Larry with the question of what is hot, what is new, what is cool, what do people want to do? And I want to talk about two technologies that I have absolutely had no involvement with yet, but it seems like people are really interested in them. One is obviously Silverlight, you know, the hip, cool, new technology that all the kids are going to be using on the streets, right?
Oh, so, yeah.
And, I mean, for organizing the code camp, there's a lot of people that want to do Silverlight talks. And we're getting our drinks right now too, so it's going to get confusing because I want
talking.
Beer.
They can't hear the,
yeah,
the
but
waiter.
I'm waiting to hear my beer. So Silverlight is obviously going to be a big one. Another one that I don't think is going to be widespread, but I find personally interesting, which is F sharp. Or more to the point, the fact that there are more and more languages. It's not just going to be the C-sharp VB world anymore. You know, with the next version of Visual Studio, F-sharp will be in. Is that correct, Aaron, right?
That is absolutely correct.
Aaron just said it's absolutely correct, so we've got him on record even though he said it. He's too far across the table for me to throw the mic at him. But we didn't even hear what I said, which is good. But I asked you, Aaron, is F-sharp going to be a official, quote-unquote, language of Visual Studio in the next version? That's what I've kind of heard, and that's not like an NDA thing. I've heard it publicly.
I've seen it on Soma's blog, so I assume that means it's not under NDA anymore.
Right,
so.
Right. And of course, we have the DLR, and we're going to have all these scripting languages there. And so I think that's going to be an actually interesting thing I think that's going to be a very interesting thing in the very near future to see all these languages suddenly come in, and we're not going to have these people moaning and whining and complaining about which language is better, C-sharp or VB. You know, it's going to be, aha, we have all these languages there that are becoming equal citizens. So,
you know, Jason, I know you're not a strong man of faith by any means, but, man, you're demonstrating a lot of faith in that statement. My gosh, I think the language wars will come on for a long time.
Well, let's keep the religion out of it and just talk about technology, because there's no religion there, right? So anyway, but continue.
No religion in technology? Are you kidding me? Have you seen the VB and C-sharp wars? No, but more seriously.
My title's evangelist. Come on. So
exactly. You know. I mean, this is, you know. But the reality is everybody's going to have their favorite language. People are going to have opinions. Exactly. Exactly.
So Aaron, are you a big fan of F-sharp?
Yes, I am.
Tell us a little bit about it. For those of us who haven't done a lot of it.
I don't know if I've introduced myself yet. My name is Aaron Erickson. I work with some of these people. I'm also a software developer, at least part of the time.
No, you're not.
I do open source. Come on. Give me a break, Jason. But the reality is F-sharp is a new language coming out of Microsoft. It allows functional programming, but it's really a hybrid, functional, object-oriented language. It runs on the CLR just like C-sharp does, just like VB does, and it can do anything C-sharp can do, and C-sharp can do anything F-sharp can do, but one's a little bit easier than the other.
Is that
doing certain kinds of things?
Is that a language construct, or just the fact that they're both, you know, coming down to MSIL?
I would say just both coming down to MSIL, because I'm sorry, somebody seems to have a VB cough over here, you know, but that's okay. And VB, I will add that, but as far as what it does as a language, it makes the defaults, right? So it's not, languages aren't just about what you can do in theory, but they're about what the garden path leads you to. And the whole point of F-sharp is to lead you to writing code that allows for immutable structures to be the default so that you can more easily write parallelizable programs. And that word is so hard to say.
Concurrent
program. That's a much easier word to say. Thank you, Jason. I really appreciate that.
So I have to be the devil's advocate for just a second, because I have a question to ask, because we have a couple of VB MVPs here. Jason, are you a C-sharp MVP? He's a C-sharp MVP. We've got a great advocate for F-sharp here. And he's a C-sharp MVP. So we've got a lot of languages represented here. Jason knows the answer, but he hasn't heard the question yet. Okay, so me as the head of development for the organization, you know, when I have pockets of developers who all want to write different languages in them, because I've got the supportability, the maintainability issue, should I allow these people to write in different languages if it all comes down to MSIL? There's pros and there's cons there, right? It's fundamentally all MSIL. It's all the same, right? But what if my F-sharp guys all leave?
I suspect that that's always going to be an issue. No matter how much we'd like it not to be, there's a lot of inertia that says we have C-sharp programmers, we have VB programmers, we have F-sharp programmers, we have Ruby programmers, so forth. We may get to some future where that doesn't matter as much, but I have no faith that that will happen anytime soon.
And I'm not talking about the Uber, the entire ecosystem. I'm talking at the organizational level. Is I can dictate. I could say no. We are going to write in language X. Let's not talk about which language it is. Is it good for a company to standardize on a language?
This is Kirsten. I got the mic handed to me. I guess the question is, as a manager, do you force a standardization on language, or do you allow developers to develop in different languages according to their preference?
Or according to a whim?
Or according whim, no. I would say no. I'd say you need some structure around it. You know, I don't know. I've never thought about that question before. It's a very interesting one.
There's a lot of enterprises wrestling with this because...
Yes, I'm in at a client right now that is having that issue.
Particularly as they're making a platform change, because there's a lot of people coming from Java. And they're saying, well, we should standardize on C#, or we should standardize on... It doesn't matter what it is, but what's the value of that? Keith?
Well, I think you started talking about a couple things right there. What is the customer coming from, or where are they already at? If they're a customer that's come, even though I'm a VBM VP, I'm not going to be foolish. I think if someone's coming from the Java world or the C++ world, that customer client developer should learn the framework with C#. And to be perfectly clear, the important thing is the framework. Learn the framework. Don't worry about the language so much. Now, if you're coming from VB6 or any other previous versions of VB or ASP, use VB as the tool to learn. You know, then it's harder when you have organizations that are both. I think you really got to look at the size of the organization and make a judgment call from there. You know, what do I do? Certainly, you don't want project teams doing a great deal of mixed languages. You know, as for F#, I think F# is really going to be used more in a particular reason rather than as a general purpose language. And that's not its purpose. So, you know, and also to go way back to the first question, I do got to say user experience in general from the, as someone who's been making decisions with Codapalooza, what we just did and had to allocate rooms and things like that, what had the most interest was user experience. So Silverlight, WPF, and other user experience changes that are going on right now were definitely very, very interesting to people.
This is Chris. As long as we're talking about hot new technologies, I guess one of the ones I'm pretty excited about is going to be XNA. I did a talk on XNA today at Codapalooza. Went really well. A lot of people had a lot of really good questions. One of the things that you're seeing is a renewed interest in XNA because there's finally a profit model behind it. It's not just a matter of hobbyists making games for fun in their garage. You can actually make money now and sell your games on the Xbox 360. So I think you're going to see a real growth area there as more and more people start to jump in on that.
Okay, this is Kirsten again. And now that I've had time to think about the question, I have an answer. This is going back to, should I standardize on one language or allow my developers to develop in multiple languages? I guess my answer is, me as a developer, I see myself as my job is a problem solver, and my job is to learn whatever I need to do and figure out whatever I need to figure out to solve the problem. And, you know, when you talk about a lot of these languages, as long as you're using the same framework, really, I mean, we like to joke and get in wars about it, but really the languages are not that different, you know, as a developer, I feel like, you know, my job is to be able to learn new technology and to adapt and do whatever I need to do to solve the problem. And so therefore I should, even if C# is my preferred language, I should be able to jump into a VB project and perform, because I guess I see that as that's what we do as developers. So I guess, yes, I would say standardize on a language because it makes your job and the manager's that much more easy, and developers should be adaptable, in my opinion.
This is Chris. I agree with what you're saying. I think one of the things we're seeing, though, is that a lot of IT managers are making a language decision based more on fear or ignorance. There seems to be a prevailing opinion that VB is going away, or that it's disappearing, or that Microsoft is gradually supporting it less and less. And, I mean, there have certainly been some times where I've felt that way as well. But overall, Microsoft's message, at least internally, is very strong that VB's not going anywhere. You know, there's been some parity issues as far as the amount of support you see in terms of help and articles and SDK support and stuff like that. But, you know, and unfortunately that's sending a really negative message, and IT managers are picking up on it, perhaps mistakenly, that VB's not going to be here in 5 years. But the fact is, you know, Microsoft's plan currently doesn't have anything to do with getting rid of VB, and and it's really a matter of what language you're personally productive in. There's no reason you couldn't have multiple languages within a project. You know, performance is certainly not an issue. It's just about what your developers can handle.
Yeah, this is Jason. Basic is not going away anytime soon. It's been around since, what, the 70s? So it ain't ever going to die, and it shouldn't. Personally, I think that everybody should be developing in IL, but that's my world, so my really weird world. To the point about F#, I find it to be kind of a cool, slick little language. Not little, but, I mean, it's little in terms of niche. I mean, I think Keith was talking about where its place is going to be before, or maybe it was you, Aaron, but somebody was over there saying that, talking about F# and where it's going to fit in the enterprise, and it definitely has merit. It definitely has value. I mean, you see Don Syme. I've seen him do a couple talks in F#. Great guy, by the way. If you ever get a chance to see him. And he was talking about F# and where it's currently being used, and at the time he was talking about how it was used to figure out the true skill rating in Xbox. And how they use this reams and loads and loads and loads of data, like I don't know how many, you know, bytes of data they used to figure out a really good true skill rating. But he said that they used, and they also did network analysis, packet analysis using F#, and the people that use it said F# was wonderful. So I just don't think that it's going to become a huge language like C# and VB is in the .NET community, but it's not to dismiss it. I think there's definitely value in using it.
So you said that F# is being used to figure out true skill? Would that be considered business intelligence?
Yes.
So F# is a business intelligence language. I just wanted to get that out there. That's all.
Okay, so let's move off of language for a minute I'll do the Jerry Springer, like I have the last word on this, because I honestly don't think it's important which language. So don't fight about VB or C#. Don't fight about, you know, whatever. You know, talk about what is the value of standardizing versus not standardizing. The other thing is, none of you guys mentioned C++. I'm gonna correct that, because we actually, next month, Dave and I will be with one of our C++ MVPs, and we'll talk about the future of C++ on the platform. But Keith, I would like to come back to one of your questions, or one of your comments, and I think that, Chris, you mentioned it with XNA. Jason, you mentioned it with Silverlight, and that is the increasing importance of the user experience and the new platforms that we've got. And XNA is not new, but it's on the uptick now. It's about to be taken off. So, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the user experience platforms. And in general, there's a little bit of a learning curve. Jason, I follow your Twitter, and you were having some frustrations with WPF the other day versus your WinForms background. So who would like the first comment on the user experience platforms and where we're headed? Ah, Jason.
This is Jason. Just let me comment quick on this Twitter thing. I was, I started with VB very many years ago, where you did the UI along with everything else, you know. And when I went into .NET, WinForms and stuff like that. But I just haven't touched WPF. It's not been my thing. Cool stuff, but didn't want to do it. So with the talk that I'm developing for the next code camp, one of the examples I thought of doing was, well, basically it's about exception handling and about every different host having a way to catch a generalized unhandled exception. And WCF, WPF, WF, WinForms, app domains, applications, they all have a way to catch an event that has an unhandled exception. And I said, well, why don't I show a WPF example? Let's stretch myself a little bit. And so I tried to do something in WPF, and I almost did a WTF, because I'm like, I just did one little change, and I'm like, and I just want to put a couple little things on here, and why doesn't it act like WinForms, darn it? You know, so just, so that's the explanation behind it. You know, I like the technology. I just have to, I'm old enough to realize I was the idiot. It wasn't the stuff. I just, you know, I'm not familiar with it. So, and I want to. So.
By the way, Twitter is the new overhearing the guy in the next cube. So, you know, it's just that you did it very publicly. I heard it hundreds of miles away. Keith?
Okay, so I got to keep this short. One, I do want to say one last comment about the last question. It's not about language. But you did bring up the IT manager and the decisions they make. I think the IT manager's got to look back and not worry about the language so much. What I see in our business is when you have IT managers that have multiple teams, multiple applications to support and build, they need to think higher up and come across with the standard framework that they use across their applications, so their developers can go from application to application and easily develop them and easily maintain them. Now, back to user experience.
Because user experience is a framework.
And yes, it is.
And Microsoft has some 30 supported frameworks right now for user experience. Even Active Documents for the VB guys, if you remember those, technically it's still supported. Don't do it. Don't do it, please.
Well, and what I was referring to more was business frameworks, and I'm talking about building business applications, right? Is use a business framework. Don't start every application from scratch, right? And don't have 10 applications that you support all done differently. And also, avoid building your own framework. So, but as for user experience, I heard that. But as for user experience, the big thing that I think is the huge change now is that we are now moving into an era where designers and developers are very important for the majority of applications. I won't say it's the vast majority yet, but simple business applications, they need to look good now.
Kirsten?
Hi, this is Kirsten again, and I'm just going to pick up real quick on something Keith said about maintenance and support. And I actually spent about 6 years supporting, being the lead developer, the lead BA, and the support on a business-critical application in a plant I worked at. Jason's laughing, but okay, it's not at me. And that experience has, every time I walk onto any project, I'm coming from the standpoint of supporting it and maintaining it because that was my life for so long. And what I found over that, I mean, there are definitely patterns of, you know, what causes, what kind of issues, you know, cause the most problems. What are your biggest hitters in terms of support? And one of the patterns is that almost all your support is going to be data related, from my experience. But coming into an application from the very beginning, thinking about maintenance and support, completely changes the way that you even start designing and architecting your application, I found. And so I just, from my experience, I find that it's really important to think about that up front because that's your highest cost.
So you're an engineer by background.
Yes.
And engineering is a very predictable science.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you...
Well, yes and no.
Yes quit, and quit no. With the train jokes, Keith, but, you know... compared to software, because you know, I think back to Flickr, and the famous story about Flickr is it actually started as like a massive online game, and uploading photos was just part of it or whatever, and it morphed into the world's photo sharing site. They couldn't predict the reuse and the maintainability of that application, and I think that's one of the issues with software. So how do we get past that? And I don't know how we got from user experience to this, but it's a cool topic.
Well, I think...
Chris?
I mean, I think... Oh, well, I was going to say, I think actually you can kind of predict that because my experience with supporting application, no matter what the application is, the support issues tend to be kind of similar in nature, and you can predict and kind of design around those things.
You know, Twitter's experiencing the exact same problem. They never imagined that Twitter would evolve into what it has. It started out as a... Hey, I'm on the corner of this street and that street. Where are you? And it's involved into this 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week groupthink experience where, you know, people are constantly chattering back and forth and having political debates and podcasting and, you know, and discussing the podcast that they're doing over Twitter while they're podcasting. And it's just this nonstop evolution. And, you know, their servers can't handle it, which is why you see the fail whale on a regular basis that... They had no idea it was going to turn into what it has.
Right. This is Aaron again. You know, and it's funny. I think the big problem is that in software, it's really easy to hide in the first couple versions the technical debt that you're producing. I mean, it's kind of funny. Today at Codapalooza, we had an open spaces where we talked about this very concept where, you know, the reason you don't have this in buildings and whatnot is because there are inspections you can do to a building that allow you to figure out what your technical debt quote is. Whereas on the other hand, in software, it's very easy to hide the technical debt until you're a couple years down the line when you end up with Twitter and a fail whale. So yeah, I completely see what you're talking about, Kirsten.
Okay, this is Jason. Do you mind, Larry, if I throw out a new question?
Sure.
To the table. Okay. Now,
and we'll make everybody here answer it.
Cool. That's even
succinctly.
Better. Okay. You know, being a consultant at Magenic for 8 years, I felt very fortunate that a lot of projects I've been on have been interesting, technically cool, whatever. But, you know, fact be known is that there's a lot of stuff I do spare time that I find just really, really fun to do. And so I'm kind of wondering, even though we like what we do, we love our jobs, you know, et cetera, what are the things as a developer that you would just, if you could do it 40 hours a, you know, a week, and I know what people say, oh, what's the job I currently have? And I get that. I'm just saying, if you could do something all the time, every day, and even if that's your job right now, okay, cool. But you know, I would say I'd love to do some, like, the stuff I do on Coplex, the projects I do right now that are really low-level stuff. For some reason, I'm weird, and I love that stuff. If I could do that all day and just explore and spend time learning the Profiler API and writing dynamic proxies and dynamic code, I'd really, really like that. But it's hard to find gigs to do something like that. So as a developer, that's really the stuff I find fun. So I'm kind of curious from the table, you know, let's not think about the enterprise. Let's not think about, you know, what's coming up, even though it's important. Just, if you could, what would you love to do all the time and get paid for it? So let's start with Chris.
So the question is if you could do nothing else, what's the most fun thing that you would do coding-wise?
Well, if it has to be coding-wise, it would be XNA and game development. If we're talking anything in the world, I'd probably quit developing and open a tattoo studio.
This is Kirsten, and what I love to do is to problem solve. I actually love debugging. Give me a problem either to figure out how to implement something or why isn't this working, a really, really hard problem, one that, you know, takes hours of Googling and banging your head and trying and you know, keep digging, and you hit bedrock and you dig some more, and you know, hours just go by and you don't even notice it, and then all of a sudden you solve it and you either get it working or you create the new functionality, and you're just on top of the world. So that's what I would love to do all day.
Hi, my name is Brian Mavity. I really just enjoy learning new. Right now I'm learning Boo. It's a .NET language, open source.
It's the one that's easy on your wrist, right? That's
yep.
What they call it? Yeah.
Yeah. IEnd has a DSL book, and right now I'm trying to get into an open source project, the BooLang Studio, which is to get Boo working in Visual Studio 2008. And they just had an Alpha 1, so I'm going to join that project. But really, I like to learn new stuff, just new languages and things like that.
So this is Keith again. So what would I like to do? You know, I can't put it down to any general one technology, but really, as a lot of experienced people, I really like to do new projects and rather than maintaining old stuff, right? I think that's generally the biggest thing that I like, is to try new things and, you know, to do whatever we can to make it, when you have to do maintenance, that it's simple. So letting you know, sometimes I talk about it with our people as more of a maintenance-driven design, so people don't have to get down into the annoying, crappy work that sometimes they have to do.
This is Aaron Erickson again. What I would do in this kind of case is, if I could do anything in the world, it'd probably be a little bit like Chris does. I mean, I got into this business because I really like video games, and I really wanted to understand how they work at a detailed level. That's what got me into programming in the first place. And so you're doing that kind of thing full time, that'd be, you're kind of back to my roots. And, you know, if I won the lottery tomorrow, that's probably what I would do.
Dave?
I mean, it's so like Aaron said, I mean, you know, talking about building video games, I mean, it's, I think, you know, when you're younger and kind of messing around with computers, it's kind of like that's what you always envision of, like, what you want to do in your life, right? And it's kind of funny because, you know, you kind of talk about games, and I'm always, when I play video games, I'm always looking at the games as not really playing the game, but how they put it together. How did they build this? And I think it's just because it's just my mindset as a developer. I mean, I do that kind of like in everyday life, to be honest with you. It's like, how does the cash register at the grocery store work? You know, there's a program behind it. How do the stoplights on the street work? There's a program behind it. So when I look at a video game, I'm always, how do they build this? And actually, okay, I'm trying to gain some geek credibility back, and I don't know if I do a very good job of it, but I actually started getting interested into tabletop gaming recently with like Dungeons and Dragons and Warhammer and all this stuff. And it's not necessarily because
are you back in middle school, Dave?
Yeah, pretty much. But it's not necessarily the game, but you can kind of see how video games are built off of these rules that these tabletop games are built off of.
The game mechanics?
Yeah, the game mechanics, absolutely. That's, you know, it's funny. I probably spend more time nowadays building games than I do actually playing them.
Right.
I feel the same exact way. The rule systems and the game mechanics and the whole engine behind it is, I mean, there's an elegance there that a lot of people don't see. There's a great story. When Bungie was working on Halo, they spent a tremendous amount of time working on the AI for a lot of their grunts.
Right.
And they put a lot of really interesting behavior that nobody in playtest ever noticed. And they ended up taking it out as a result because it was just a little heavy on the processor. But, you know, they spent a lot of time having certain characters react certain ways when the Master Chief was around or in certain situations. And nobody playing it ever noticed any of it. But going back and looking at a lot of that, I mean, there's some really just incredibly interesting stuff going on behind the scenes that it makes the developers happy, and they feel like, you know, hey, we've done this really cool thing, but unfortunately, a lot of players never really see it.
Right. I mean, so yeah, you know, I will have to say, Larry, that my wife is looking at me like, what are you reverting back to, a 14-year-old? I mean, have I hit a midlife crisis here? You know, I've actually played my first Dungeons & Dragons game last week, right? I'm a 38-year-old male who played my first D&D game last week. Gorbert said something funny, but I didn't hear it, so all right, smart ass. Okay. We'll get you back. Anyways, go to my Flickr account and you'll see some nice pictures of Gorbert. But anyways, so as part of playing D&D, you buy the books, right? So D&D just came out with this new edition, you know, these new rules and everything. I had no clue what all that stuff meant. So I bought the player's handbook, but as you read through the book, you can see it's all stats-based. And you can start looking at that, and you can see language in there. You can see rules. There's a rules engine in D&D. So there's different stats, and you can kind of see how they build these game applications. And it's like, it makes sense. I can see it. You know, it's now you want to go out and build that game to kind of follow this rule set.
All right, so do I get to answer the question now? And this we'll wrap it up with this, is that I think that we're working on a lot of things to solve the semantic problems, you know, with the web. But nobody is talking about time, right? So there's a real difference, you know, between being able to search things and find things and all that and being able to tag them up. And everybody's doing it from a monetary commerce thing. But I really want to solve the problem of the pictures from downtown New York City on September 10th, September 12th, you know, 2001, and then September, you know, 11, 2005 are completely different. I would like to solve the problem of time in the semantic web. It's a very, you know, noble cause, right?
Time travel?
You know? No, not time travel, you know?
Although time travel would be totally awesome.
But, you know, so I'm a big photographer, and I'm talking about from imagery, right, you know? Because we've solved, you know, tagging. So when I take a picture, I can put your name on it. I can put the location that we're at. I can describe, like, she's wearing a nice pink blouse, so I could describe it as pink and blouse. And we could search on all those semantics. We've solved geocoding, so we know that we're at Charlie's, ale house in Wheaton, Illinois. We know, you know, exactly when we were there because we've got the timestamp of the photographer. No, I'm not talking about auditing for imagery. She didn't have the mic when she asked the question. But really, how have you changed over time?
Well, that would be an audit trail, wouldn't it? Change over time is, I mean, I'm not saying literally.
Such
but
the engineer answering the, you know, it's, oh yeah, we could do this with an audit trail.
I'm not saying it's literally, but I mean, if you're talking about that, I'm thinking that basically what you're describing is an audit trail of imagery over time, right?
In a way, yes, but, you know, how have things changed?
Right. Well, that's an audit trail, right?
Yes and no, right? Because you're thinking about it from a very, like, yes, I've got a timestamp on everything.
Well, of course, because I'm an engineer. But, okay, tell me more.
But you can't just, you can't just timestamp because, you know, because it's how you've changed, how things have changed, right?
So you're basically thinking about Flash. I mean, I remember when Flash first came out, I mean, kind of the thing was it didn't record all the images. What it recorded was the difference between the images.
So you're talking about keyframing or something like that?
Yeah, way back when. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're jumping into the solution. I mean, fundamentally.
Well, of course. That's what I do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to solve this problem, but I know that there's a difference between, you know, different times, and
right.
we're not doing a good job of capturing that. So, so the Internet Archive, right? I mean, that could play into it, right? But that's how websites have changed over time, right? So I can go back and see what Amazon.com looked like in June of 2002, right? We're really not capturing the essence of something, you know, right now. We totally got to cut this out of the podcast.
No, we're not. But Kirsten has given you the evil eye on this one, man.
No, not the evil eye, the questioning eye. I'm trying to understand better.
Yeah,
so that I can problem
better.
Solve.
Well, he is an architect, so he thinks in big pictures and whiteboards and stuff.
Oh, see,
markers.
I'm a very, very, very detailed person.
Well, you're the engineer,
yes.
You know, I'm the architect, right? And most architects do not design something that is fundamentally buildable until the engineers get involved. And there are changes that you have to do, you know, to go from architecture, from the big thought, into implementation. And that's actually why my blog is called Eraser and Crowbar, because there are two tools that you use.
Mm-hmm.
On the drafting board, you use the eraser. You know, on the job site, you use the crowbar. So, So Kristen, you going to work on me with
What's
this
that?
On me? You going to work with this on
oh,
me?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
I got kind of off on a tangent. I was pontificating on the whole game mechanics and building games and stuff, but I don't think I really answered the question. So even though Larry, you kind of say, hey, this is the last thing. You know, I always got to go beyond that, right?
No, you got the last question, buddy.
Okay, so kind of what do I want to build or what do I want to work on? That's the question. So it's not really a technology per se. I don't care really what technology I work on, to be honest with you. As long as the tools are good, the languages are good, the technology is good, what I want to do is I want to work on stuff that's cool, to be honest with you. You know?
And everybody at this table agrees that we all want to work on cool stuff, right, everybody?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so Kirsten, what did you say?
Well, I just said cool is in the eyes of the beholder.
It
and
is.
That's why we all have different
is,
answers
honestly.
To the
so,
question.
So when I was a consultant, you know, I was working behind the big corporate walls of various different, you know, Fortune 500 organizations. How many, you know, damn customer profile screens did I build in my life? How many login screens did I build in my life? You know, it just wasn't exciting. The coolest project I did work on, however, was an opportunity for my mother to actually see my work. And it was an application for a record store, the FYE Entertainment Stores, you know, kind of like your typical mall music stores. And they have the little listening and viewing stations in the on the store shelves where you can pick up a CD or pick up a DVD, scan it on this device, and it would either play a video if it was a DVD, or it would bring up sample audio tracks of the CD that you could listen to. And I was actually responsible for all the data distribution that you would bring down to all the stores to support that. And if you think about that, that's a ton of data. That's a lot. That's terabytes, terabytes, terabytes of data. And you can't, well, at least back then, this is back in the early, you know, 2000, 2001, you can't push all that data down the store. So we had to come up with an algorithm to determine what data would be most requested from a particular store. So whether that store was in an urban area, or whether that store was, you know, in Nashville, Tennessee, or wherever, you had to sort of come up with an algorithm to determine what was the chances of this particular CD being picked off the shelf, this particular DVD.
Sounds like F-sharp would be a perfect language for that.
unfortunately, it didn't
exist back then. More business intelligence, yes.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so we kind of came up with a solution of, you know, whether, you know, it was recent released, whether it was top sales, you know, this various other algorithms. So it was a fun project to work on, because it was actually data that I cared about, because I was really into music, and it was actually something that my mom could see my work, where everything else was behind the big corporate walls. But when I quit my consulting career, looked at working for somebody else, that, you know, it didn't end up being Microsoft, you know, fortunately, which is the best decision I made. But I wasn't necessarily looking, when I was looking for a new job, I was looking for companies I wanted to work for, like companies like Disney. You know, I'm a big Disney fan. How cool would it be to work on applications for, like, the amusement park management system? You know, the number of people walking through the turnstiles, or a cruise ship, right? Yeah, on site, exactly. So, I mean, just you know, places that were working on interesting applications that you can relate to versus just customer credit applications. Or, you know, I worked on an application where you order cell phone service and you turned on different services and stuff. You want sexy, right? That's right. So it's really about, you know, the type of application, the type of business, which was really important to me.
Well, I would say to that, and this is Aaron again, you know, without sounding too sentimental, I think most of us want to work on something that's got at least a little bit of impact in the world. And there's a lot of work that gets done that has like zero value. Yeah, well, I've seen it.
I would say that there's a lot of uncool stuff, but that does create a lot of value also. Because like,
there's that too.
Adjudicating insurance claims has a lot of value. It is totally unfun. Trust me, as somebody who used to work in the insurance industry, it's not sexy, as Kristen said. Yeah.
You're not telling me my entire career has been wasted on just, you know, mundane application development, right?
No, not at all. But there's a middle category of stuff that's not fun, but it has value. There's also a lot of stuff that just has no value at all. That's busy work that we want to stay away from. So
right. I mean, yeah, you want to have an impact, right? The work that you do, the time that you spend, you want to have an impact, which is important. And that's just, you know, how you want to live your life, honestly. And we don't want to turn this into the Thirsty Developer Philosophical podcast, you know. So why not?
All right, and with that, I think we're going to wrap it up, folks. I want to thank all of our guests here for being on the show. And, you know, we'll put your blog or Twitter feeds, you know, in the podcast notes so people can get a hold of you. So, everybody, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.
This is Chris Williams. It was awesome. I assume you're editing all this later?
No, we don't edit this.
Awesome.
No, it's going out like this, so...